Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome to the Say What special presentation of Woo Woo Reality, which is a series of podcasts that will then hopefully be put into text for a book. My name is Nancy Hopkins, and the date here is January 9th, 2026. Today's subject is going to be reincarnation. Now, I knew nothing about reincarnation. Like I said from the beginning, I was a Catholic, and that wasn't anything anybody thought about or talked about. It just wasn't part of my reality. And that remained true until I was working at a nursing home. Now, in another chapter, I may go through all the various jobs I had, providing different glimpses at reality, as we know it, 3D reality. And the, let's say, woo-woo aspects of those particular jobs. But right now, I'm just going to tell you about my first introduction to the concept of reincarnation, which happened when I was working at a nursing home. And the nursing home shift was from, I guess it was 11 to 7, something like that. Anyway, I was on they had three different floors. The bottom floor was for people that were ambulatory and, you know, had a life. And the third one was for those that needed more care. And then you had a situation where, you know, they're really in their final days, and they would go to the second floor. Well, I was on the second floor, and that night there was an LPN, a licensed practical nurse, and then there was the RN. And the RN was not normally on that floor, but for some reason she was that night. So I'm doing my rounds, and I was doing them by myself. I'm sure that there were other people there, but I was by myself. And I check in this one room, and I look at the guy, and I, you know, take some of his vitals, and I go, "Whoa, this guy's not in good shape." So I went to the desk, and both of them, LPN and RN, were sitting there. And I said, "I've got a guy that seems to be really having a problem. Please go look at him." So they look at him. They look at his chart. He's a diabetic. And I can see that they're getting very concerned. So as they got concerned, I got concerned. And they started talking, you know, together. And there was two options. Either he had had his insulin was off, and they would need to give him a shot of whatever the diabetic medicine they had to give him, I guess insulin, or it was too much. And in either case, it could put the guy into a comatose state, which is what he seemed to be. And they're going back and forth and back and forth, and they're getting more agitated with each other because they really were searching for the answer. And this guy is very close to death. And all of a sudden, I just started talking. Now, I knew I was talking, but I really didn't. It was almost like the stress of the situation caused me to go into a state of non-thinking. What was I supposed to think about? I didn't know what they were talking about. And then all of a sudden, this voice comes out of me. And it was talking about all sorts of medicine and signs and this is this and this is that and da 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 da. And they're looking at me kind of stunned. And then they looked at each other and they went, "She's right." And so they started to do whatever it was that my voice had told them to do. And meanwhile, I kind of like, because now there's something getting into my mind that seems to be associated with me, I started to think again. And I knew that this voice had come through me, but I had no idea what it was saying. What, I had no idea about anything about diabetics. So I go down to the desk area, and they have a big book on medicine. And I look up diabetic, and I'm reading it, and like I kind of recognize the words because I know I was saying those words, but I had no idea what they meant. And I really didn't understand what I was reading. Now, neither of those nurses said a word to me after the fact. But I was like, what in the hell just happened? Remember, I don't have any inkling of reincarnation at all. But I'm of the sort that something like that happens, a woo-woo thing really outside of anything I had experienced before, it's going to make me start thinking and analyzing. And that's exactly what happened. I started to go back to the moment that this voice started talking through me to determine whose voice was it. Well, I can't really remember the sequence of events, but I don't know if I was, I think I would start thinking about it when I was about to fall asleep. And I might have set up some kind of a almost dreamlike sequence. But it also could be what is technically called meditation. And really, what you're doing when you're in a meditative state is you're listening for the word of God. Praying is asking God for something, and meditation is just listening. So your brain kind of gets quiet. All the chatter that goes on in the brain normally is just shut down. And you're listening for, well, in my case, I just want to know what the hell happened regarding that strange voice. So I started to, I actually think what was happening was that my preoccupation with the voice was what I call an anchor. And every voice is absolutely different. It's got its own frequency. I think what happens when you remember, like a reincarnation life, what's happening in your mind is that you've gone into a meditative state. Sometimes, I mean, meditative states will happen. I mean, essentially, when I couldn't, my brain shut down, I was in a meditative state. So I was open to hear that voice and tell them what to do. So as I'm, focused on the voice acts like a anchor. I tell people, I say, when you're going to go into remote viewing, it can be dangerous because you don't know what timeline you're going to be on. So you need some kind of an anchor. And we're Ani Avedisian, and I was asking her about this, and she said that when she did remote viewing, she would find a newspaper and look at the newspaper to make sure she was on the right timeline, which I thought was pretty clever. But knowing what all I know now, my analysis of what happened to me is I actually did a remote view. And what happened was that I'm thinking about the voice, and all of a sudden I'm out of body. No, I'm not out of body. That's the wrong thing. You're not aware of your body. Because I think that when we do remote viewing, we're actually bringing the scene to us. We're not going to it so much as we're bringing it to us. And that's just my interpretation of what I feel when it's happening. But all of a sudden, I was in a room that was obviously a small room with a, it was like a hotel room, small, and a bed in it, and but it looked like a hotel room. And there's this man who's looking out the window, and I just, as soon as you think to do something, you kind of do it. So I ended up slightly behind him, beside him, and looking out the window too. And what I saw was, I think it, well, I'll tell you what it was because I eventually understood all of this, but it was a very, very late 1700s, early 1800s city street that was cobblestone. So we're back in time, way back in time, and there's a cobblestone road there. It's weird because even though I didn't know anything about reincarnation, this felt natural. Like, oh. And I don't remember going and researching about it or anything. I just kept going back to that time, kind of understanding this guy. He was a doctor, getting glimpse of who he was and, what time frame he was living in. I did not get a name, but that wasn't even of a concern to me. But anyway, this is going on. And some months after this, and this time frame was well, it was, I had graduated from college. So I think this was like the 70, 71 time frame. And my friend Barbara, who I've mentioned before, she got married to a guy named Tommy. And she was still living in the area of the University of Massachusetts. So she and I decided I'd go out and visit. And while I was there, I found out that she was doing radio, interestingly enough. And it was just a school. I don't know if it was associated with a school somehow, but she was doing what we call them podcasts now. At the time, it wasn't internet radio. It was a real radio station. So she, excuse me, she asked me if I was interested in going on the show because she knew that I knew a lot about woo-woo stuff. And she, her guest that day was Sybil Leek, who was a very famous witch. But she wasn't going to be there for long enough to cover the whole show. So Barbara said, you want to come down and talk for half a show? Yeah, sure. Okay. That sounds like fun, which we did. So that night, we had finished dinner. And we were basically smoking some grass and drinking some wine. And I was talking with Tommy. So it was Tommy and me and Barbara, and we were like in the kitchen area, kitchen dining area. And he said to me, he had heard the radio show. And I had said something that he questioned. As a matter of fact, it was on reincarnation, I think, because it must have been. I must have learned a little bit more about it because when he said that to me, I'm going to tell you what my answer was, which was very bizarre. Now, remember, I'm a little bit stoned and a little bit. Not drunk, but drinking wine. And so when you're in that state, you're really on the edges of metaphysics, I mean, meditation. So I'm going like, okay, and I answered the question, but the answer surprised me. And what I said was, well, do you remember France? And he looked startled. And I noticed a strange, Barbara was doing something to the sink, which was off to the right. And all of a sudden, Barbara also reacted to that statement. And I said, you were my son back in France in the 1800s. And she was your mother. And she was in line for the French. It was actually late 1700s. She was in line to be. She was the first child, and there were no males in line for the king. She was royalty. And for a while there, you were the dolphin of France because there wasn't anybody else that was a male descendant except through Barbara. Well, both of these people were like this by this time, very weirded out. I wasn't particularly weirded out, but they didn't pursue the conversation. They kind of like backed away from it. But the way that they did it made me think that. And I said to him, you remember, don't you? And he kind of shook his head, yes, but I didn't even ask Barbara. We just went on doing what we were doing. But I will say I never got invited back. Okay. I didn't put that together about the relationship until he asked me the question. So I. And at that time it was like so many things were happening that I remembered it, not as clear as I remember some things, but pretty damn clear. And I never gave it too much thought for some reason. Can't tell you why. Okay, so we've got the doctor experience that led me to know that it's likely that in reincarnations, you're with the same soul spirit in many of them. I mean, the three of us were all in the same family, related, And you see that kind of thing. I've done a lot of research into reincarnation now, and yes, that's something that seems to be a truthism, okay, in reincarnation. It wasn't until I got into the military that the subject, the thread of reincarnation really kicked in. My first station was basic woman's training, and it was at Fort McClellan, Alabama. My roommate at the time and I were both transferred to the intelligence school of Fort Huachuca, Arizona. So she gets it up, hey, let's go over to Tombstone because Sierra Vista, where the fort was, Fort Huachuca, was about 20 miles to the west of Tombstone, Arizona, excuse me, Tombstone. And Tombstone was still kept like it was in the 1870s, middle 1870s. So we planned this trip and we asked another one of our friends that came from McClellan to Huachuca. Her name was Ada. Now I knew Ada just because of McClellan, but mostly because of Huachuca. And we had had some funny situations with her. She was a Native American Indian from, I believe, Arkansas. And she, her tribe believed in reincarnation. And they also did hallucinogenics, the cactus one, peyote. And so we'd had conversations about that type of thing. But she goes, she's going to go to Tombstone with us. And we're in the car, and it was, I guess it was the summertime, because when you're driving, and you've, all of you probably at one time or another have done this, when you're driving and you're either driving or in the passenger seat, I was in the passenger seat, you can get virtually in a, almost in a hypnotic frame of mind, or more like a meditative frame of mind, because you'd get this heat on the pavement that would cause like this waving, I don't even know what they call it, but it's you know the heat and the cold, and it's, you know, you get this weird thing. So it's kind of like this little energy field that's running in front of you, and you got to be careful with it. So I don't have to worry about driving, so I'm just, you know, looking around, and all of a sudden I said, "What's the river doing there?" And it startled me. Now, Ada was in the back seat, and she said, "Well, that's the Sierra Vista River, and there was a earthquake 100 or so years ago, and the river slightly altered its course. It's about a mile different than what it was." And I turned around and I looked at her, and I looked back at it, and I said, "Ada, I don't even know where this river is." And she says, "Right over there, look at the green. You see the green all of a sudden?" And then I could see it. And I said, "So there's a river there." And she said, "Yes." I said, "But how would I have known that?" And she kind of laughed, and she said, "Maybe you lived here before it moved." So, okay, weird situation, but I don't know that I dismissed it. But it, I wasn't preoccupied with it. So she and I and this other girl, I can't remember her name, tell you the truth, we were just going into different places looking at it. Now, to get the feeling, it's like going back into time, and you're back in the 1870s when Wyatt Earp and his brothers were the known people that were, you know, when you hear about Tombstone, you know about that. But the other thing about Tombstone was the gunfight at the OK Corral, which was between these local, they called them the Cowboys, and then the Earps are the law. Well, in that time frame, the cowboys would go out and they would steal cattle from other farmers, you know, other people that had cattle farms, and then claim them that for their own. And I'm assuming there was branding and stuff, but it wouldn't stop those guys. They were really tough, nasty people. The guy who was the leader of this group of people was a man by the name of John Heath. And then there was the McClories, and I forget what the others' names are, but you know, he was the boss man. Well, according to what happens next, I was there. I had a reincarnation there. And the reason that I know this is because we'd be walking around. We were in the OK Corral, in the area of it. And there was a door. And I went to open up the door, and it was locked. And I kicked it. And it startled me. And, you know, Ada saw it happen, and she said, "What just happened?" And I said, "I went to go through a door that I'd gone through many times, and it was locked." She said, "You did live here. You lived in Tombstone." She said, "You're picking up the lifetime that you lived here." She said, "You're probably feeling like you're phasing in and out." And I said, "Yeah, that's exactly what's happening." So the next thing that happened was we go into the Imperial Cafe. And of course, now it's modernized, but it used to be like a saloon. And I go to the bathroom, and it was a small one toilet type of bathroom thing. And I go in the bathroom, go to the bathroom, and I get to the sink, and I'm, washing my hands, and I looked into the mirror, and looking back at me was this guy. And he's got a mustache, and he's like looking at himself. And I started, my hand went up to my mustache, his mustache, and it was a quite a few moments before I kind of like reacted to what was happening. And as soon as I questioned it, it boom went away. So I go back to where Ada is, and this other girl, I don't remember her name, and I'm telling Ada about it. And she said, she got all excited. She said, "Whoa, this is fun, And I'm going, "Yeah, fun." Okay. So then we're walking down the street, and the street has still got the wooden, I guess pathway, that was down the street, and then you had the dirt in the street. And there was an energy field that when I got there, it was like, "Oh my God, oh my God." And I did a remote basically. And I was in this body, and there's a guy standing in front of me. And I pull out this gun. He's got his gun out, and I shoot him. And he falls dead in the street. And it was like kind of traumatic. And I said to her, "He killed somebody here. He killed somebody here." And the girl that was with us, she said, "Yeah, there's a sign right there. It says Luke Short killed Charlie Storm," and gave the date. I don't remember what the date was now. And so I look up at it, and I said, "I didn't see the sign." And Ada said, "Whoa, now you know his name. His name is Luke Short." Oh, okay, cool. So we go through, there's different stores you can go into, and so places you can get drinks and stuff, very expensive drinks. And but we go over to this place that was now a museum, but at the time had been the courthouse. Tombstone was pretty big place for that time frame, and it had the courthouse. So we're in the courthouse, and we're just walking around and looking at things. And in this one room, kind of like off to the side, but in the middle of the room, was this plexiglass display. It was standing there. It was on, metal legs, and there was this plexiglass display. So I walk up to it, and then boom, I'm like into this whole story. And it flashes through my head like, "Oh my God." I wasn't thinking about it. It just all of a sudden I'm seeing this whole panorama of story. So what I was seeing in 3D was this presentation discussing a man by the name of John Heath. And John Heath was the leader of the Cowboys, like I said. And something happened. They didn't know what, but something happened, and the Earps were after him. And so he had to leave Tombstone, and he went down to Mexico, but he had a good portion of his gang with him. I mean, a good portion. I think there was three, four, five, somewhere in that area. And they go down to Mexico. And then they came back to the Tombstone area, where his team robbed the bank in Bisbee. Now, Heath was not a part of it, but they robbed the bank. Heath was arrested and tried for the robbery, but he was acquitted because he had an alibi. Well, the townspeople got so excited and pissed off that they broke into the jail where I was in, the building I was in, and dragged him out and hung him on a telegraph pole. There's actually a picture of Heath hanging from the telegraph pole. So that's what this thing is telling us, telling me. But the next thing I know is Ada is shaking me. Come back, come back, come back, she's saying to me. And I like in a daze, I said, "What's happening?" She said, "Whatever you were looking at put you into a trance." She said, "What happened?" And I said, "Well, I'm not exactly sure what happened. But I think that this guy, John Heath, killed Luke Short." And so she had me, tell her what I had seen. Well, what I had seen is Luke Short, and like you get extra stories that you're not really seeing them, you just sort of know. Luke Short was, you had the Earps there, the family, but the guy that was really running the show was Luke Short. And so he was sort of the leader of the Earp gang at the time, but you're not going to see any of this in the history books. I'll tell you this, and I'll tell you why. So Short, I mean, Heath believes that the problem with the Earps is Luke Short. He felt that if Luke Short was killed, then that's going to be the end of the Earps. The cowboys will be able to go back to being, protected by the law. The sheriff there was on their side, sort of, so to speak. They bribed him or threatened him. I'm not exactly sure what it was. But he thought that if he killed Luke Short, and maybe there had been something between Short and him. I don't know. I didn't pick up on that, but I did pick that up off of Short and the way that he was viewed by Heath. So Short is in the Imperial Cafe, sitting at the bar. And John Heath is a young man. This is why he left Tombstone. This is the Earps were after him. Taking out the head is not going to really hurt the Earps. So he would that's why he was escaping the Earps to get down to Mexico. So Short is absolutely stinking drunk. And he's sitting at the bar. Heath walks in and calls him out. Now, Short had nothing warned Short about what was happening. He was so drunk, he just turned. But as he turned, he dropped his right hand off of the counter towards his gun. John Heath thought he was being drawn on and took a shot at Luke Short, which hit Short in his gut. And he fell right off of the stool. He landed in the dirt floor of the saloon. And the last thing he seemed to feel at the time that he died was embarrassment. He was embarrassed. But I mean, it was a lethal shot. So Heath and the part of the gang take off. And the Earps and Doc Holliday were so pissed off about this that that's what instigated the gunfight at the OK Corral. Okay. They kind of ambushed the five people that were there, the cowboys. And you can read all about that. Maybe you've seen the movie. It's a great movie about it. So, you know, by the time I get out of that museum, I'm completely like wonkered, like, oh my God, what's all this about? And exhausted. I was very tired. Now, granted, we were walking around all day, but I was in the best physical conditioning that I had ever been in my life. I shouldn't have gotten that tired. But before we leave, they want to see Boot Hill. And Boot Hill was a very famous graveyard with all sorts of kind of bad known characters. So, okay, all right, you know, all I want to do is go to sleep. But we go to the tombstone cemetery called Boot Hill. And we're walking around. Now, at that time, I was very much into photography, and I happened to have a Polaroid camera with me. Well, I'm just stumbling around looking at these crosses and these tombstones, and all of a sudden I'm looking at a tombstone and it said Charlie Smith. Sorry, Charlie Storm. And I'm looking at this thing and it says, you know, he died in a gunfight with Luke Short. I take a I don't think it had the whole gunfight, but the death thing. It was just a standing, you know, wooden, I guess they call them tombstones, I'm not sure what. And now that was like another, oh my gosh. But I take the Polaroid out and I take a picture. And that was the only, I had one picture left in that camera. I didn't know it. But that's the one I took. So 2 weeks later, we're talking to a friend of mine that her husband was with her. And he was an interesting guy. I hadn't really, I mean, I'd met him, but I hadn't had any conversation with him or anything. But he had medically retired as a colonel in the United States Air Force. And this was the time of Vietnam. So they hear about our trip to Tombstone. They think that's going to be a fun trip. So the four of us go again. And Ada was not with us, but, you know, myself, the other one, I can't remember her name, and the Robinsons. Yes, their names were Robinson. And they both had the nickname Robbie. Kind of confusing. So we go back and we're doing the, you know, the looking in the shops and stuff. And he seemed to be a little bit bored. I'm not sure, but I know that he said to me, "Hey, you want to go get a beer?" And I said, "Okay, yes, absolutely." I wasn't having any flashbacks. I wasn't having, nothing had been flashbacked at that time. I actually wasn't really thinking about it because I was engaged with these two new, well, one of them, Robbie, the girl, yes, I knew, but her husband was very interesting. So we go to this little place and we're getting these beers. And the beers were half like a small glass. They weren't very much at all. And I think we were into our third or fourth one. When he says to me, now let me give you a background in him. He was medically retired from the Air Force. But one of the stories he told me was how he had gone across the bridge, Charlie Point, I think, what do they call it? It was in West Berlin and East Berlin. And it was this checkpoint, Checkpoint Charlie, this checkpoint. And across that bridge, the Russians brought the pilot of the U-2 spy plane that had crashed, been shot down actually with a missile in Russia. And Gary Powers, his name was Power. And he was being brought, exchanged for American, Russian prisoners. But he was there at Checkpoint Charlie when Gary Powers was doing this exchange. And the reason he was there was he personally knew him, Gary. And he was testifying that this is the right guy. And he had already told me that story. So that's the kind of caliber of officer this guy was. He was very interesting. So we're drinking the beer, and all of a sudden he said to me, "I need to apologize." And I said, "For what?" And he said, "It was an unfair gunfight." Well, I nearly came right out of my chair, because now I'm back in the Luke Short scenario. And I don't know if being in that place that was kind of locked in time was what made him make the connection. But I said, "Oh, okay." And of course, the first thing that happens to me is I think John Heath. I said, "Do you know the name John Heath?" And he said, "No." And so I tell him about what happened to me in the museum, and the whole reincarnation story I just told you, I told him. And he said, "Yes." He said, "I don't remember the name, but I do know that I was lynched," and he said, "and I was hung from a telephone pole." And I said, "No, it was a telegraph pole." And he went, "Oh, yes, it was." And then the girls came in, and we never said another word to each other. I never had another conversation with him. But what he said was that that's how I knew about John Heath, that he had shot Luke Short, because he's telling me the whole story about how he thought that Luke Short, the whole story came from him. I mean, I got flashes of it, but the real concrete information came from him. So we never said anything more about it. Now, I'm not sure if he went through the same kind of memory thing, remote view. I don't know about any of that. For all I know, somebody had walked into his body and pretended to be him and told me this story so that I would know the whole story was true. I mean, I don't try to make, I don't limit the way that things can happen. But now I've got a whole story about Luke Short and John Heath. So I leave the Huachuca area, and I go up to Fort Devens in Massachusetts. And then I'm stationed in Virginia in Vint Hill Farm Station. That's when I became intricately involved with the intelligence community, the Sig Sec that I explained earlier in the book. I can't tell you what really triggered my memory of George Patton. I know that at one point, when I got out of college, I did try to get a job teaching history. And I went to three different places for interviews. I wanted to teach history. So this last one was on the west of the school, University of Massachusetts. But I had never gone west like that except when on the highway. But now it's this little town that's west of the college. So I can find the college, of course. It's about an hour and a half from my house. And there was no GSP and navigation, GPS and navigation and all of that. It was just a map and flying by the seat of your pants. So I get to the area that the town's supposed to be in, and I actually drove by the history school, I mean the high school, where I was supposed to have the interview. And I drive by it, and I kind of like, is that the school? But very soon after I said that, momentarily, there is, and it's a very small road, two-way, but small. And all of a sudden, there was like, I realized I was in the Berkshires. Up till that point, it was like you realize you're going into the mountains, but you're not surrounded by the mountains. And all of a sudden, the mountains were like surrounding, and there was this valley. And the town was in this valley. As soon as I saw this picture, I got the deja vu thing, I'd never felt that before. Even in Tombstone, it wasn't deja vu. Like, I'd been here before. I was just captivated in what was happening. But this time it was like, I had no idea what was causing me to feel this. I've been here before. But I did. So I turn around, I go back to the high school, and I have the interview. And while I'm talking to the guy, we got chit-chatting about the town, And he said, well, the only thing that we're known for is that George Patton's wife grew up here. And this was the first introduction to George Patton. I didn't really know. I knew he was a general in World War II. I don't know. I don't think I saw the movie with George Scott until after this. But, if I had seen it before, I would have known that Patton was the metaphysician, blah, blah, blah. And I don't feel that I knew that when he said that to me. So that started something up, like a memory that wants to come through. But I didn't give it too much credence. I just, oh, okay, The deja vu thing was standing out, but not so much the connection to Patton. So I go into the SIGSEC environment and full-blown military. It was very obvious from even the earlier schools that I had a familiarity with the military. When we would do these training exercises to show us how to be intelligence officers and looking at tactical things and all of this, everything about it seemed familiar, but not in a deja vu way, just familiar. And it didn't take very long before other people were noticing that I had this incredible ability to talk war. I understood battlefields. But at Fort Devens, we were taught about electronic warfare. That's a totally different kind of warfare because intercepting signals from the radios of your enemy, protecting your own radios. In this day or in that day and age, it was the radars were out there on vehicles, and I mean, there's a lot to about it. Not like it is today, but at the time, there was a lot of things that were happening, but it was only happening in a very small select group. Because to go into what was called the Army Security Agency, which was where Sig Sec and Sig Inc. come from. That's their headquarters. You had to be chosen. You couldn't, most people didn't know about it. And what they knew about it, they called them the super spooks. But these are the guys that were on the forefront of trying to understand how all this new technology was affecting the battlefield. So, and of course, I didn't know anything about electricity and none of that stuff, none of it. But when it came to understanding how it could affect the battlefield, again, it was like, whoa, I had some kind of inner secret to it. It was very easy to me for me to understand all this. So then I get to Vint Hill Farm Station. And that had been just prior to the Civil War and during the Civil War, a farm. Now here's another woo-woo connection to it, to me in the very location of Vint Hill Farms. The post had been there to, and during the Cold War, it had been there to monitor signals coming out of Cuba. It had a vast array of high frequency radars, picker-uppers, receivers. And the facilities were basically just World War II barracks. I mean, you had the classes in the barracks, the barracks were the barracks still in some instances. And they had the farmhouse was now the officers' quarter. So for a while there, I was living in that building because I hadn't got an apartment when I first got there. So I'm living in this building. And then it also was where the officers would go to lunch. And they had a, officers' club where you get snockered if you wanted. Well, I found out after I'd been there, actually, that my mother's brother, my Uncle Glenn, he had been a major in the army. And he was a code breaker. So they wanted to set up some kind of an intelligence school. And don't you know, they picked Vint Hill Farms. So initially, he was the one that took that farmhouse and made it into a military post, teaching intelligence. And then they used the same facilities to put these high-powered radar receivers on it. And by the time I got there in 63, 62, 61, no, 70, 72, I think it was, 73, maybe. When I got there, it was very, very small, but they had this one building on it that was absolutely, you had to go through Marine guards to get to a high security building. And I told you about that when I was talking about the remote viewing and where my office was. That's the biggest building on the post. And then you had all these small wooden World War II vintage buildings. It was very, very unique. So, like I say, I had a reputation. I'd written the program instruction for the intelligence school. I was very good at tactics, and I'd done well at the electromagnetic, the EW field, school in Devens. And then I was reading it's essentially the SOP, standard operating procedure, for the unit, the Sig Sec unit that I was in. And they said that this particular unit was responsible for telling the White House and the higher echelon of the Army, generals, chief of staffs, that sort of thing, what the threat to our own electromagnetic technology was. And there was a civilian, these intelligence organizations, they have military people, but they have a lot of civilians, many of them prior military. And the reason for that is if you have a military person there, that it depends on the what's happening in the world, but they might be there for only 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and then they're gone. And you need continuity in remembering things, basically. So the civilians did that. I can remember in being in meetings and some officer would say, "Well, what about this?" And somebody, a civilian, would say, "No, we tried that 3 years ago. It didn't work." You know, that type of thing. So the guy next to me was one of the civilians in this open office type of thing. And I said to him, "Are you aware of that this is required of the agency? And are we doing it?" And Bob, he said, "Oh, I'm aware of it and I know we're not doing it." He said, "I used to have to be doing it, but then everything got so different that we've kind of forgot that." And he was like, "Oh, yeah, we're supposed to be doing that." And I said, "Okay, thanks." And I go into the colonel's office, the guy that's the commander of the agency, and I said to him, "Do you know that you have this problem that you're not fulfilling this mission and it's in the SOP?" He said, "What? What?" And I showed him. I had this SOP. I opened it up. I said, "You're not doing that." And he was like, "Oh my God, of course not. I didn't know we had to do it. Oh Lord." I said, "Don't worry about it. I'll do it for you." And he said, "What?" And then that's when I told him about putting together the whole Russian thing, Warsaw Pact tactics at the intelligence school. So he said, "So you're telling me," and I said, "Yeah." I said, "Just, I've got Bob, he used to do it. He'll get me up to snuff." Okay. And so that was my job. He assigned me to fulfill that mission. Well, to make a long story short, it was a very, 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 very intense and difficult thing to do. Because the Russians, who at that time were the Soviet Union and, the Warsaw Pact type of thing, Russia is just one part of the entire Soviet Union. The Ukraine was part of it. I mean, it was all kind of under one banner, the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union, as Russia prior to that becoming the Soviet Union, was involved in World War I with the Germans. And they realized that the Germans, they could listen to the Germans talking over their radios, and that information would tell them what the battlefield looked like. So the Russians did tremendous damage to the German army because they were listening to the radio, their radios, with German translators. So they never forgot that lesson, and they were much more advanced in electronic warfare, battlefield warfare, than we were. We were way behind. Yes, we knew about the radios and the radars, but these guys were very, very technically savvy. Their troops had been trained not to use radios the way that, they were able to win World War I. There was so much more to what they were doing. So it was a very time. I mean, you had to do a lot in a short period of time. And I referenced this when I said I chose the people that were good at telepathy, because I knew what kind of a project we were into. So during this time frame, I had a lot of high-ranking military coming and going in my office, asking me about this and that and the other thing. And some of them were kind of taken with themselves. And they didn't like a lieutenant. And not only that, a female lieutenant telling them what to do. So what would happen is that was almost like George Patton took my body over. And they're trying to, control me, put me down, do the I'm better than you are thing. And I wouldn't, I would get nervous. I honestly would get nervous because the intimidation that these officers use is impressive. So I'd go a little blanky in the mind. And then all of a sudden, it was like I was a totally different personality. And these officers that are trying to intimidate me are now talking to somebody that it didn't take me long to realize was George Patton. And my staff, especially the two that were telepathic, they saw this happen a number of times. And they said to me, what just happened? I said, I think George Patton just took me over. Because when I somehow or another, I realized, and I'll tell you the connection to George Patton. When I got fascinated with, okay, who's Patton? And I started to research him. And what stood out was the fact that he was a sharpshooter, exceptional on a horse, and a few other things that made me see a connection between him and Luke Short. So when this weird character came in and took over and stuff, I felt like it was Patton. So I just identified him as George Patton, And sometimes they'd come up to me and they'd say, "Why don't you let Patton in?" But what happened that made me absolutely convinced it was George was I was sent to Fort Hood, Texas. I can't even remember why I was there, but I was there. I was probably giving some speech. I used to go and talk to different units about electromagnetic warfare. And I might have been there for that, but I just don't remember. But I remember being there. And we were out at the officers' club, and we were pretty snockered. But they had this game. And I don't even know what they call it now, but it was one of those kind of early video games where you're controlling it like a coin operated thingy, like sometimes you're shooting. Well, this was playing with tanks. And Fort Hood is the home of the tanks. The units there are, tank units. So we were playing with that, and it was like nobody could beat me. It was just like, I actually got bored with it. And so I'm talking to one of these captains, and I'm still a lieutenant at the time. And he said, like I say, we were pretty snockered. And he said to me, "Would you like to meet the commanding general, General George Patton, Jr.?" And my response was, "Hell no, I didn't like him when he was my son. I don't want to see him now." And again, it was like, and the guy took, he was like, "What'd you just say?" And I, caught myself and I started laughing and I said, "No, I don't need to see another general." But that's the response that I got from the energy field that I felt was George Patton when he was given the opportunity to see his own son, which I found a little disturbing. Why didn't you want to see your own son? But again, I was gradually being acclimatized to working with Patton. If I was in a situation where I had to understand the battlefield, it was Patton that was looking at it. I was just learning from what he was looking at, how he was thinking. So I felt very, assured that, yes, indeedy, it was George Patton. But then when I got out of the active duty, I went into the reserves, and there was a civil affairs unit. Now, these guys go into a country and work as the go-between, the military and the civilians, civil affairs. A very, very important part of any kind of a battlefield. But they're only there in a war, and we weren't having any wars. That was a good thing. So to do the reserves, you have 2 weeks a year that you go for 2 weeks. Once a month, you'd go to the unit to train. But you also had to put in 2 weeks of active duty. Most of the time, it would be used to go to school, which in some cases, yes, I used it to go to school. But in my case, I was being brought out. The 5th Infantry Division finally kind of became the place to go. And they were bringing me out there because they would have an exercise concerning Germany and the Russians, the Warsaw Pact, Soviets. And they would have me play the Russians, the Warsaw Pact, whatever the scenario was. So I was always playing the enemy. And they had to train against me, try to outthink me, outfox me, outmaneuver me. Come on, guys. And it's only me. And there's a division of different layers of the division who are all attempting to do the same thing to me. But like I say, it wasn't just me, it was George Patton. So I never lost a battle. I never once lost these things. I could do such damage to the American army, it was embarrassing. One time we had an exercise on Panama, and it was a battle between the Soviets and the US, and we were losing badly. So they brought in some more troops. They figured, oh, Christ, we can't do it for the ones we thought, so we got to bring in some others. And they're bringing these guys in. And as they're coming in, I attacked them with the Native American Indians. My God, you'd think, I mean, they called me a cheater. I said, how am I a cheater? Well, you can't have the Indian. I said, I can if I built the scenario and I could go back to see, I'd send out messages as to what I'm doing. And in those messages, some of it is just intelligence on, well, one of the things is that somebody put sand in a gasoline for the trucks. Well, that means they're about to attack you. They're trying to disable you. So things like that, And I had continually, for the first 2 days of this exercise, the 3-day exercise, I had been sending off, the Native Americans are having a riot over here. There's this guy that made that, and I'm building the background of, no, I can use the Indians. So again, this is kind of like indicative that George Patton is very, close to mind. So one time we were at, I had, actually, it was a class. It was a training class at Fort Huachuca. And It was on electronic warfare. I guess I don't know. I don't remember what it was, but I went Russian tactics, and we get there, and they pull out this field manual, and it's called The Aggressors, and it's got the entire understanding of how the Warsaw and Soviet troops operate on a battlefield. So they put this in front of me, and I start going through it. And I went to the instructor. I said, "Will you get me to a telephone so I can make a call?" And he said, "You got an emergency?" I said, "I need to talk to somebody in my old unit." And he said, "Oh, okay." So they give me the phone. I call my old unit. And it was a civilian that worked with me. I haven't mentioned him, but he worked there. So I t said to him, "Todd, are you familiar with the field manual?" And I gave him the numbers on it. And he said, "Oh, yeah. Yep. He said, "Why are you?" I said, "I'm in school and they just gave me this book to learn." And he started laughing. He said, "Well, you wrote it." And I said, "That was what I thought was happening." I said, "What happened?" And he said the higher echelons of the Army Security Agency had sent down a team, and they took all of the records that were there when I was there. He said they brought them back, but they had copied them all, and then they made that manual out of those documents. And I said, "Okay, thank you." So then I go back to the professor. Or the instructor, he's just an army guy. And I said, "Are you at all familiar with this book?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, I wrote it. So let me help you get this class right." And he was, "Will you? I don't know what the hell they're talking about." There was actually two of them. And I said, "Not a problem. We're going to do this, you know." So while I was there, some of the people that I was there, again, they're military people, they said to me, "We're going to go over to Tucson," which was, I don't know, it was probably an hour and a half away, I think. I don't, it was quite a ways away to the museum. They got a history museum, we thought, on the university. We'll go out there and we'll take a look at the museum. And I said, "Yeah, that sounds like fun." So we go over there, and it was the Tucson University's history museum. And we're It's an old building. It's one of the original buildings. And we're walking around and we're looking at all this cowboy stuff. And, you know, I think there was, gee, I think that day there was five of us. But some of us are going in this room. We're all by ourselves, you know, doing this thing. And there's only so much cowboy stuff you can see before it gets boring. So I go in this room and I'm looking around and I'm like, "Oh man, I'm bored. I wonder when we're leaving." And I walk out of the room and this guy that was with us, but I didn't really know him, I hadn't interacted much with him at all. He says to me, "You go back into that room. You missed it. Go back into that room." And the way he said it, it was like, "Oh, okay." I turned around, I go back into the room. I'm going like, "What the hell is that about?" And I get to the far side of the room, and all of a sudden I got this really weird energy thing. And I turned around quickly and I looked across the room. It was a small room. Across the room. And saw something in the glass case that was there. It was drawing me to it. And I got to it. And it was a gun. And it had I guess it was a pearl handle on the gun. It was like a 45. And it said, "John Heath." This was John Heath's gun. It said some stuff about Heath, who he was. And I'm just absolutely in a state of shock. Thankfully, I took the picture. In a state of shock. And this other guy comes in and he said, "There you are. We're going to be getting on the road." And I said, nothing to him. He just looked at me and he went, what's wrong? What's happening? And so I said, oh, you're not going to believe this, but I think I got shot with that gun and killed in a bar room in Tombstone. And he said, oh my God. He said, I belong to the Edgar Casey Foundation. I totally believe in reincarnation. And from that day on, to the time I was there at that, school, this was my best friend because he was so into the story of Luke Short. I didn't tell him about the Patton connection, but Luke Short. And so the next day, he said, we're going back to Tombstone. So I think there was only three of us that went to Tombstone, but he was one of them. And we go over to Tombstone and we go to the courthouse, to the museum. We go up to the plexiglass display of John Heath. Everything was still there. And he's nothing happened. I didn't get tranced out. Nothing happened. And he said, will you just stand there for a while and see what happens? And then he kind of left. And I stood there for a while, but nothing happened. And then he comes back and he says, hey, come on, come with me, come with me. I said, all right. So I follow him. And when you go into the courthouse, when it was a courthouse, you take your saddle and you'd leave it in the saddle room, a small room where they would just pile the saddles in there so they wouldn't get stolen. And he said, he points to this, it didn't have saddles in it. It was more museum pieces, like furniture. And he points to this one. It was some, if somebody was sitting in it, it would be like the level of a card table. But it wasn't, a perfect square like a card table. This thing had a length to it, and it might have been 3.5 feet, maybe. Yeah, sounds about right. And it wasn't very deep. It might have been 2 feet deep, maybe 2.5 feet deep. And the table had a cutout where the dealer would sit. It wasn't much of a cutout, but it was that's the dealer. That dealer sits there. And it said, Luke Short dealt faro, FARO, at this table and some date. Faro is very much like poker. And he's saying, sit down, sit down, sit down. And I'm going like, I don't think I want to. I really didn't want to. He says, sit down. So I sit down and I hadn't sat there for very long before I like whoosh. There's like a whoosh and I've in a bar room. But not visually in the bar room so much as I could smell the bar room. I could smell everything. They don't smell good. And that's the only thing that I got from that sitting down at that particular table was the smell. Very, very kind of like, oh, very familiar, and a little overpowering. So now I've got this concept that adds to the connection between George Patton and Luke Short, because Patton, well, somebody said he had a pearl handle. He said, I've never used pearl, it's ivory. But it was a white handled pistol, 45. Patton was so good at what he did that he actually, as a young lieutenant, entered the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. Now, this is acknowledged as like the first modern Olympics. All these nations were there. It was a pretty darn big event. Well, I never knew that Patton was there until a friend of mine, Jean Rockefeller, she sends me an email and she said, Jack told me to tell you that she's still mad, he's still mad at Patton for losing the Olympics. And I said to her, what are you talking about? And she said, well, apparently he was at the Olympics and he was riding Jack in one of the challenges. And she said, I didn't believe what Jack was saying. Jack is a horse, by the way. That's a very long story. But Jack is one of the watchers who's here to act like a conduit, like Ben the Cat did. But this is a horse. And he had been sending messages to Jean for, at that time, quite a few years. That's how I knew her. That I met her, she was Jack the Watcher's caretaker type of thing in that whole story. But we became friends. And now she's telling me that Jack, in specific, wants me to know this thing about, he's still mad at Patton, about the Olympics. And I didn't know anything about the Olympics, nor did she. But Jane, kind of like any good metaphysician, checks things. So she did a search on Patton at the Olympics. And sure enough, don't you know there's a picture of Patton on Jack doing a jump. And it turns out that Patton couldn't take his horses or his horse across the ocean to participate in this Olympics. But the military had horses and they offered athletes, the choice of their horse to compete with. So Patton had gone down to the area that they were all corralled in. And he's just walking because it turns out that he was a very highly evolved metaphysician, Patton was. And I'm not really going to get into too much of that, but he could feel the energies. And he was walking along, and all of a sudden he walked by this horse, and the horse reached out and bit him in his left shoulder. He turned around, he looked at this horse, and he said, I'll take that horse. Now, that was like really, really weird to me. Because when I was probably about 9 years old, maybe 10, a horse did that to me. My relatives had these friends that had horses, and we went over there, and one of them came up behind me and bit me on the left shoulder. It actually made it bloodied up a little bit, but it made a mark. It was there for a long time, that mark. So I said this to Jean. I said, oh, well, okay. there's a connection, here. And so then by that time, I was having, let's say, conversations with Patton in my head. Whether I was making them up or they were real, it didn't matter. I always got information. Your imagination itself will bring you information. So I said, what the hell is this? What's this all about? And he said, we were doing, he told me what it was, but I don't remember, but it was a series of things you had to put the horse through. I think there were like five of them or something for this, Olympics thing. And he's on Jack, and he didn't really have any, well, Jack wasn't his name at the time, but he didn't really have any time to ride this horse. I mean, he was basically, the horse didn't know him and he didn't know the horse. But they get out there on the pathway where they've got to do these jumps. And what happened was that Jack was an unbelievable horse. And he could do things that Patton had never felt a horse do before. So they're coming up on a jump, and Patton thought the horse had stumbled or was about to stumble. His gait was off. So he corrected him. And in fact, Jack was making a turn to make this jump. But that little correction cost them a second in the time. It was a timed event. And Patton lost coming in first in the Aquarian event of the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. And he was still pissed at Patton. So, I mean, the Patton connection was getting deeper and deeper as I went through my life here. The Patton connection was not, well, Patton and the doctor and Luke Short. They were always kind of players and things I would think about and, situations. Like when they handed me an M16 rifle, we had to take three shots down the range. I was absolutely terrified. I'd never shot a weapon in my life. So boom, boom, boom. And the instructor goes down and he takes the thing off the target off and he brings it up to the student. And he comes up to me and he said, I thought you never shot before. I said, I haven't. He said, well, I've never seen anybody do this. And you could see there were three bullet holes, but they were almost making only one bullet hole. You could have put a dime over it. Now that was because I was freaked out. And so probably Patton came in and actually fired the gun, the weapon. Okay. That's what, because after that, I couldn't do anything near that when I was firing by myself. Then we had to also shoot the 45 pistol that officers carried. Well, we're in, before you can even shoot it, you have to be able to take it apart and put it back together again. So we're in that process of learning that. And this girl that was next to me, I'm watching her out of the corner of my eye, and I'm realizing that she is not doing it right. Now, by this time, I knew I was dyslexic. And in dyslexic, there's two signals that are were there. I think probably everybody has it, but some people, they just don't emphasize one, because once you are on the one that everybody's calls a standard, the other one just fades away. But in a dyslexic person, they're both there. It's like in computing, it's like parallel computing. I happen to think that some of the more brilliant minds are probably dyslexic, because you've got all this information that's coming in that other people don't have. However, it does cause a problem. I could never spell. To this day, I have problems with names. I learned tricks like if somebody says to me 3642, it might compute in my mind as 2463. My mind doesn't deal with that kind of a concept, but I learned that if they say 3642, that's what I see. That's what I remember. So I learned a lot of tricks to help me with this dyslexic thing that was very under control, because I wasn't having any problem taking apart the pistol and put it back together again. But then again, I already knew how to do it from George. So I said to her, have you been diagnosed with dyslexic, being dyslexic? And she kind of looked at me like, yeah. He said, "All right, let me show you how to do this." And I showed her how to put the gun together, and she was able to put it together. So we go out onto the range, and you're standing there in a line, parallel line, and the targets are in front of you, and you got the 45, and each person who was shooting had a NCO, staff officer, I mean, an NCO, somebody, a training officer, right beside you. So I'm looking down. Now I'm shooting a pistol that I've never shot before. And all of a sudden, the guy standing next to me yells, "Downrange, downrange." And I looked to my right where he was standing. She was on the other side of me. I hadn't even noticed that. I mean, she had that damn 45 pointed towards me and him. So, the guy that's with, for some reason, I don't know why he didn't do it, but anyway, they got her settled. She seemed to be all right, but I don't know that because I turned around to the target and went boom, 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 and emptied the entire chamber. And the NCO standing next to me is like, "I have never seen anybody shoot a gun like that." And he goes down and everything's, a dime could have been over it. It was because George shot the weapon, not me. I mean, there were these things that I kept seeing happen. But I also had certain situations with other memories of reincarnations. One was this guy that was like the caretaker of a forest in medieval France. He didn't have a family. He didn't have any love affairs. He basically lived in the woods by himself on this huge, some knight or somebody owned it. But his immersion in nature and the animals and his ability to communicate with everything, that's a real big part of me. A lot of that tendency in me is because of that experience, in my opinion. So, and there's, I could go through others, but I'm not not going to. I just want to say something, kind of been wrapping this up. There's the first book I wrote was Cosmic Reality. And it provides rules about the universe. One of those rules is there's a finite number of souls. And I never really understood what that meant. But I understand, okay, so you only got these many souls, but the question is, well, if you've got X number of souls and you've got X times 100 people, how's that work out? What's happening? When I was growing up, there was a He had people that would have mental problems. And a lot of people said that they had been Napoleon. Well, how can that be if all these people were Napoleon? Well, maybe. Maybe the reincarnation experience really comes from accessing a life. It's like a computer file that's, in this case, George Patton or Napoleon, that you're accessing that life as a memory in order to get certain teachings. Every single person out there has a purpose of being if they've got the soul. So, we shouldn't limit the ability of the soul to pick and choose what lifetime they want to carry with them in order to drive this vehicle that we call the human body. the human consciousness. So to say that I'm the only one on the face of the earth that could say that their reincarnation of George Patton is not true. Many people could think that they were the, or not even think it, but have the information that went into the collective consciousness from George Patton. So I don't want people to think that I live my life like I'm a reincarnated spirit from George Patton. I'm a spirit inhabiting a body who has access to the George Patton bank of knowledge. And that's true for any memory, in my opinion. I'm not saying it is. It could be that there's only me and him. But I don't feel that that limits the spirit and the ability of spirit to learn. So it's just something to throw out there. You know, I'm telling you my experiences and the people that I think, because of a lot of signs, are real people that I got the information from, the storylines. And there's that other thing about timelines. If you look up Luke Short, you'll find out that he lived in Tombstone. But you won't see anything about him dying there. He died years later, someplace else. And when I first came across that, because remember, Google and search engines and stuff, all of a sudden you got access to everything. When I first found that out, I thought, wow, is that making all that up? What the hell is that all about? And for a while, I just like, well, I'm not sure. We can't limit the ability of the soul to learn. So whenever you think that, you know, you're feeling some kind of deja vu or memory of something, accept it as real. It's what's influencing you now. Whether or not you actually got involved in that is another story. And timelines are another story. So the fact that Luke Short does not, in the history book, reflect what I have as a memory does not mean that my memory is wrong. It might mean that I have a memory on a different timeline than the timeline that's here. I'm going to end the show here. I don't have any idea of how long it might be. There's more to reincarnation, and we'll learn more about this, that, and the other thing. But I hope you realize that when you're getting information that doesn't seem to make any sense, pay attention to it, because it might take years before you really understand it. I appreciate you all. Be safe, and I'll see you next time.
Say what? Say what radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.